This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering Gardner and the towns of Ashburnham, Hubbardston, Petersham, Templeton, Westminster, and Winchendon. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashburnham, Petersham, and Winchendon. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Gardner News, covering the week of May 21st through May 27th. This is Dave Russell reading with Alexandra Zapantis. Our first story, Hubbardston voters prepare for town meeting and election. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. The annual town meeting is set for 7 p.m. June 1st in the Hubbardston Center School Gym, 8 Elm Street, with the town election following on June 9th. Paper copies of the warrant are available at the town clerk's office, 48 Gardner Road. A digital copy is available on the town's website under the town meeting section, according to a community announcement. The annual town election will be held from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. June 9th at the Hubbardston Center School Gym. The polling entrance is at 7 Main Street, the back door of the gym. More information, including a specimen ballot, can be found on the town's website. The deadline to register to vote is 5 p.m. May 30th. The town clerk's office will be open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. to accommodate the deadline. Residents can also register to vote online. Officers on the ballot and candidates running for office are as follows. Select Board, 1 3-year term. The incumbent is Catherine V. Young. Select Board, 1 year term. The incumbent is Albert Afonso. Board of Library Trustees, 2 3-year terms. Incumbent Krista F. Goguen is running for 1 seat. Cemetery Commission, 1 3-year term. Incumbent Raven Brangwyn Caldera is on the ballot. Planning Board, 1 5-year term. Incumbent Christopher Monroe. Finance Committee, 2 3-year terms. Incumbents Charles Edwin Reed and Hunter Allen Young are on the ballot. Board of Health, 2 3-year terms. Board of Health, 1 2-year term. David Richard Rogers is on the ballot. Quabbin Regional School Committee, 1 3-year term. Gail Moncur. Quabbin Regional School Committee, 1 1-year term. Jennifer L. Rogers. Board of Parks Commissioners, 2 3-year terms. Incumbent Hunter Allen Young is on the ballot for one of those positions. Board of Parks Commissioners, 1 1-year term. Kenneth Canfield is on the ballot. Voters can sign up to vote by mail in the town election or in person at the town clerk's office. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on June 2nd. In-person early voting will be at the town clerk's office, according to the announcement. Early voting hours for the annual town election are as follows, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on May 30th, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. June 1st, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. June 2nd, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on June 3rd. A public test of voting equipment to be used in the annual town election will be held at 10 a.m. June 2nd in the basement of the library at 7 Main Street. Our next story, Westminster PFAS delays drag on, bottled water service cut. This is written by Amelia Cardona. A permanent solution to the PFAS contamination in Westminster has been delayed for over 4 years, but the free bottled water service many residents received has been discontinued. Potentially responsible parties, including Mass Natural Fertilizer, Seaman Paper, and Otter Farms, are required to connect homes affected by contamination from per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances to the Westminster Municipal Water System. Until recently, while residents waited, they received free 5-gallon bottles of water from the water delivery company, Primo. The State Department of Environmental Protection's goal is to connect the 200-plus properties with contaminated wells to the town's public water system, which is free of PFAS. It's already been done for 15 properties, and the DEP in March ordered the companies that it named as possibly responsible for the contamination to connect more homes to town water by June 30th of 2027. Those companies missed earlier deadlines and haven't started the work, according to the state. Vinnie Miola, a Westminster homeowner in the PFAS contamination area, said he moved into his current home in 2015 and his family's well water was absolutely perfect. We allowed them to install the POET, P-O-E-T, that's Point of Entry Filtration System, because we thought this would go away very soon, Miola said. The bottled water gave us comfort, and now we don't have it. They really don't see us as humans, but as addresses or a statistic. Miola said he doesn't trust the water from his faucet to be 100% safe, even if the potentially responsible parties tell him it's safe enough to drink. He said they deserve water that is not only safe, but that they feel confident to drink. 4 years later, conditions have changed. 190 point-of-entry systems have been installed in affected homes, and a federal court order in Ryan versus the New Group et al. Permits discontinuation of bottled water service when PFAS testing shows no detection or if access for routine testing and maintenance is denied. Christina A. Engberg, a member of MNF's legal team, stated that routine testing and maintenance will continue for all POET systems. Every time Scott Ledoux turns on the faucet in his Amber Road home in Westminster, he notices the same problem, water that smells like sulfur and appears discolored. Despite these concerns, his family is expected to drink it. They believe that what they did with the POET treatment systems has made everything perfect, but nobody wants to drink it. Everybody's scared of it, he said. Ever since they put the POET systems in to get rid of the PFAS, we've had discoloration in our water and a sulfur odor. Every night when you're brushing your teeth, it smells like sulfur, and now they've threatened to take the bottle, he said. I'm not drinking the water. I don't want to drink the water anyway, even if they are constantly telling me it's safe. Neighbors started talking with each other and comparing the correspondence they received because it wasn't clear exactly what would happen to their bottled water and dispenser. In early May 2026, vans from the bottled water companies like Bayberry and Achieve began picking up empty bottles and dispensers. Miola said some of his neighbors still have 5-gallon bottles of water and no dispenser, so they thought the PRP was switching to a new bottled water company. There was a lot of confusion. We were told to put out bottled water with our Primo dispenser outside, but with no explanation, and the people who did leave their dispenser outside don't have them anymore, Vinnie Miola said. We weren't told about leaving them outside meant we weren't getting them back. He said he thought when his family received the notice about the discontinuation of the bottled water service, he thought he wasn't one of them because of the severe staining in his water. After seeing what happened to his neighbors, Miola said he emailed Westminster town officials, state officials, and MNF legal counsel, stating that he wouldn't allow them to take his dispenser and water. But on Friday, May 8th, the bottled water company took 11 5-gallon bottles of his family's bottled water from his garage. Miola said he still has the dispenser in his home. I'm so frustrated that they went on my property and took my bottled water. My garage door was open, but I told them through an email that I do not give them permission to come on my property to take any of my water or dispenser. Miola said his family has about 2 weeks of bottled water left, but after they run out, they will not drink the faucet water and will have to buy their own bottled water. Now we turn to an upcoming event in our community. Montapalooza Music Festival to feature live music, food trucks, and vendors. This is written by Kimberly Green, an AI-assisted reporter. A new music festival is set to debut this spring in Winchendon. Montapalooza will launch May 30th at the Winchendon Community Park and Amphitheater, according to a community announcement. The event will run from noon to 9 p.m. with a rain date of May 31st. The festival will feature live music on two stages, a vendor area, and food trucks, according to the announcement. Montapalooza was created with a simple but meaningful mission to showcase and celebrate independent musicians, strengthen community connections, and highlight the creative culture of the Montachusett region, the announcement reads. The festival lineup includes a diverse roster of artists from across New England, according to the announcement. The Far Out will headline the water stage with performances by Joey Witt, Hotel Saturn, The Maladaptive, and Kilroy. The Sun Stage will feature John Gerard, the Bluesberries, Seth Newton, and the Can Collectors. Tickets are $20 in advance, $25 at the gate. For more information, visit montapalooza.com. That's MONTAPALOOZA.com. This story from Winchendon, lawyer disbarred after accusations of misusing funds. This is written by Brad Patrician of the Telegram and Gazette. A Winchendon lawyer has been disbarred after failing to contest allegations he misused client funds, lied to clients, forged signatures, and made false statements under oath. Jeremy L. LaPointe, who was admitted to the bar in 2010, violated more than two dozen rules of attorney conduct, the state's Board of Bar Overseers alleged. Public records show Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Justice Gabrielle R. Wallahogian approved a bar request for disbarment in February after LaPointe failed to defend himself. The records show LaPointe, who declined to comment when reached by phone Thursday, May 21st, was accused of deceiving clients, a colleague from whom he borrowed money, and bar investigators. LaPointe's law license has been suspended since May 2023, records show, and he is required to notify all clients of his disbarment, return any money for services not provided, and file an affidavit with the state swearing compliance. According to the bar, LaPointe falsely stated under oath in June 2023 that he had complied with the terms of an initial 6-month suspension, affirming that he had informed all clients when he had not. LaPointe, over the course of the bar's investigations, failed to produce documents or comply with a subpoena to give statements under oath, the bar alleged. LaPointe's alleged misconduct with clients spanned years, the bar alleged, beginning with shoddy representation in a 2016 will dispute case and culminating in forging documents in a personal injury matter. The bar alleged that LaPointe, prior to his May 2023 suspension, admitted to failing to file a lawsuit in a personal injury case before a legal deadline and then lying to a client about it. According to the bar, LaPointe falsely told the client the insurer had offered a settlement, then paid $9,000 of his own money to her, providing her with a fabricated letter misleading her into believing he'd settled. In mitigation, the respondent suffered from several serious medical conditions and depression during the representation and was hospitalized for medical reasons, which contributed to the neglect, the bar wrote. In other cases, the bar alleged LaPointe borrowed $33,500 from a colleague in 2022 to pay a client who complained that her personal injury case had not settled, then used a $20,000 settlement from another client to pay back the colleague. The bar alleged LaPointe never told the second client or the colleague what he was doing and that he forged multiple signatures, including those of a client and a notary public, to effectuate the scheme. LaPointe, a year later, paid the client whose $20,000 case he'd fraudulently settled a personal check for $13,059, her estimated share, the bar said, then falsely told the bar that she'd given him permission to pay his colleague with the $20,000. The Board of Bar Overseers alleged LaPointe's conduct violated more than 24 rules of conduct, including ones involving dishonesty, forgery, and false statements under oath. The Office of Bar Counsel, which can make criminal referrals, did not immediately return a message seeking comment on whether it had made a referral in LaPointe's case. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now Alexandra Zapantis joins us. She has more Gardner news for you. Alexandra?
Thank you, Dave. Mount Wachusett Community College named three student speakers. This is a staff report for the Gardner News. Three students addressed graduates, families, faculty, and friends during Mount Wachusett Community College's 61st commencement ceremony, held on May 20th, according to a community announcement. The speakers were selected to represent each of the college's academic schools based on their academic achievement, leadership, perseverance, and commitment to their communities. Lila Marie of Fitchburg earned her Associate of Science in Interdisciplinary Studies, Allied Health, with high honors. She served as president of the Commonwealth Honors Program and is also a Commonwealth Honors Scholar. A first-generation Kenyan student, her journey at MWCC reflects resilience, self-discovery, and strong self-advocacy as she navigated personal and academic challenges while developing a clear purpose in healthcare. Marie has gained hands-on experience as a behavior technician and certified nursing assistant and works as a lifeguard at the Mount Fitness Pool. She gives back to the community by volunteering at Monty's Market Food Pantry and Haywood Hospital. Outside of her academic and professional pursuits, she enjoys playing the violin and bass guitar. She will continue at MWCC for the next 2 years to pursue her associate degree in nursing with the goal of becoming a registered nurse. Gabriella Rondeau is speaker for the School of Business, Science, Technology, and Mathematics. Gabriella Gabby Rondeau of Hudson, New Hampshire, earned her Associate of Science in Environmental Conservation with highest honors and was the recipient of the Environmental Conservation Curriculum Award. A thoughtful and resilient student leader, she is passionate about community, connection, and lifelong learning. Rondeau embodies the perseverance and curiosity of the MWCC spirit and looks forward to continuing to grow and cultivate new opportunities beyond graduation. Melissa Gates represented the School of Liberal Arts, Social Sciences, and Education. Melissa Gates of Fitchburg is earning her Associate of Arts in Liberal Arts and Sciences degree with highest honors. A 43-year-old first-generation college student, Gates returned to higher education through the Mass Reconnect program after years of believing college was out of reach. Balancing life's responsibilities while overcoming self-doubt, Gates found strength in community, rediscovered her sense of belonging, and proved her own potential through her academic success and determination. These students exemplify the perseverance, leadership, and transformative power of education that define the Mount Wachusett Community College experience, said MWCC President James Vanderhoeven. Their stories inspire not only their fellow graduates, but our entire college community. MWCC's 61st commencement ceremony celebrated the achievements of the class of 2026 and recognized the accomplishments of graduates across the college's diverse academic programs. For more information about commencement, visit mwcc.edu/celebrate. This story was created by Kimberly Green, kgreen@usatodayco.com with the assistance of artificial intelligence, AI. Journalists were involved in every step of the information gathering, review, editing, and publishing process. Learn more at cm.usatoday.com/ethical-conduct. Westminster residents push for new traffic data on Adams Street 40B. This is by Amelia Cardona with the Gardner News. Westminster residents continued to fight the proposed 40B project on Adams Street during the Tuesday, May 19th public hearing on the project's traffic study. Residents have voiced their concerns about how much a large apartment complex, a single three-story building with 48 units and 102 parking spaces on 4.6 acres of land, will affect traffic patterns of downtown Westminster. The majority of people here are not against 40B or affordable homes. We just wish it to be somewhere else, Betsy Hanula, a member of the Historical Commission, said. This is a very poorly planned development. Traffic is the most important issue with this project. What did the traffic study say? Dewberry Engineers is the consulting firm hired by the Adams Street project developer, the Normandin Group, LLC, to conduct the traffic study. The traffic study was conducted on December 17, 2025, at four intersections: Main Street and Route 2A, Adams Street and Main Street, Church Street and Main Street, and Bacon Street and Main Street. Residents who attended last Tuesday's public hearing were outraged that the study was conducted in December, during the winter, when traffic is typically lower due to the weather. Residents stated that they wanted the traffic study to be redone in the spring or early fall, when pedestrian, bike, and car traffic is high and the risk of accidents is elevated. Town officials hired a traffic engineering consultant to conduct a peer review of the study. The peer reviewer recommended that the town request that the developer conduct a traffic study anticipating delivery trucks, given that increased online orders are the norm for Americans. An estimate of 23 cars will use Adams Street every hour, according to the traffic study. The study determined that the 48-unit apartment complex will have minimal impact on traffic patterns. Gregory Fagan, a Bacon Street property owner, pointed out that the engineers only used crash data between the years of 2018 and 2023, while more current data is available. The Westminster Zoning Board of Appeals agreed with residents that further traffic study needs to be conducted. The next public hearing regarding the Adams Street 40B project is on Tuesday, June 16th. The ZBA said the June 16th meeting will focus on a study on stormwater drainage. Podcast revisits 2023 murder of Breanne Pennington in Gardner. This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. In Gardner, a newly launched true crime podcast is delving into the murder that rocked the Chair City 3 years ago. Murders in Massachusetts, which is dedicated to exploring unsolved murders and criminal investigations across the Bay State, features the case of Breanne Breezy Pennington, who was shot and killed allegedly by her husband, Aaron, in their Cherry Street home on October 22, 2023. Host Jonathan Power said he wanted to cover the Pennington murder, which is the subject of his podcast's second two-part episode, because residents remained deeply unsettled by the incident. You have a young family, a mother of four tragically killed inside her own home, and then a husband who seemingly vanishes without a trace, Power said. There are so many layers to the case: the timeline, the search efforts, and the unanswered questions. From a storytelling standpoint, it's one of those cases where people feel there should be answers by now, yet there still aren't. Aaron Pennington, who immediately fled the scene of the crime, was charged with the murder of his wife by the Worcester County District Attorney's Office, which determined that his wife had died from a gunshot wound to her head. A days-long manhunt was launched in the wooded area off Kelton Street near Camp Collier, where Aaron's vehicle was discovered the day after the killing, but the search turned up no evidence of the suspect. I also felt this case was important to cover because the case is still active and ongoing, Power said. Keeping conversations around cases like this alive matters. Search for suspect remains active. After researching the case extensively for his podcast, Power said he tended to believe that there were still important pieces of the story that remain unknown to investigators. Cases involving disappearances can sometimes break years later because of a single overlooked detail, a new witness, technology advancements, or someone finally deciding to speak, he said. So, while the longer someone remains missing, the more difficult the case becomes, I do think it's possible there could eventually be answers. Whether that means locating Aaron Pennington or finally understanding exactly what happened remains to be seen, Power added. Podcast aims to bring local perspective to true crime cases. Power said he decided to start his own true crime podcast because he's always been drawn to storytelling, psychology, and understanding the events that shape communities long after the headlines fade. Growing up in Massachusetts, I realized that there are so many cases, both solved and unsolved, that people either never fully heard or eventually forgot about entirely, he said. I wanted to create a podcast that approached these stories with a more narrative, thoughtful, and locally grounded perspective. The goal of each episode was not to provide shock value to listeners, Power added. It's about exploring the human side of these cases, the ripple effects they leave behind, and the questions that often remain unanswered for families and communities, he said. For the Pennington episode, Power interviewed Breanne Pennington's aunt, Brenda Hall, and Gardner News reporter Stephen Landry. The podcast's first two episodes explored the killing of John and Geraldine McGee, who were found shot to death in the living room of their Andover home in 2011. New ambulance arrives just in time for Westminster Fire Department. This is by Stephen Landry with the Gardner News. It's a new ambulance to the rescue at the Westminster Fire Department. The department has received the new emergency vehicle, which will serve as Ambulance One, to replace an ambulance purchased 10 years ago, according to Chief Kyle Butterfield. He said the new ambulance was arriving just in the nick of time. Our current Ambulance One has been out of service for approximately a month due to a mechanical issue, leaving the department operating with only one ambulance until the new vehicle is placed into service, he said. Our ambulances are on a 10-year replacement cycle, so this vehicle is arriving at the appropriate time. The new vehicle, which is a 2026 Braun Chief XL ambulance on a Ford F-550 chassis, and came with a price tag of $467,000, was ordered in October of 2022, but due to supply chain issues and manufacturing delays, was received by the department a year later than originally expected, Butterfield said. The vehicle being replaced, a 2016 Braun Chief XL ambulance on a Chevrolet 4500 van, will be refurbished and acquired by the Gardner Fire Department, according to Butterfield. Ambulance One, a twin to town's other ambulance. The department's staff would not have to spend much time familiarizing themselves with the new ambulance, according to Butterfield, who said the vehicle was essentially a twin to the one that was purchased in 2020. A considerable amount of time was previously spent designing and laying out that 2020 vehicle to best meet the needs of the community, he said. As a result, when it came time to replace our oldest ambulance, we used the same specifications with only very minor modifications. Identical ambulance provide firefighters with seamless transition between vehicles. Butterfield said the department's two ambulances were laid out identically, with equipment stored in the same locations to make transitions between one vehicle to the other seamless for firefighters. Still, firefighters will complete a basic orientation and training program for the vehicle, according to Butterfield. However, because this ambulance is so similar to our current fleet, we do not need to provide the same level of extensive training that would typically be required for a new engine or ladder truck, he said. There were other advantages to having a twin fleet of ambulances at the department, according to Butterfield. Another benefit is that it allows our mechanics at the DPW to have greater parts compatibility when it comes to repairs, rather than having to stock parts for two different chassis platforms, Butterfield added. Ambulances in the Braun line also come with an important safety feature that eliminates blind spots for firefighters responding to accident scenes on busy highways, according to Butterfield. They are equipped with a sliding door on the side of the patient compartment, which is an important safety feature for firefighters operating on roadways, he said. This design reduces personnel and vehicle exposure to passing vehicles, which is especially important while operating on Route 2. Unlike traditional ambulance doors, the sliding door does not swing into traffic or open into obstacles in confined spaces. New features include powered patient loading and unloading system, air conditioning. Additionally, the new vehicle comes equipped with the department's first Striker power load cot fastener, which improves operator and patient safety by supporting the cot throughout the loading and unloading process. The system means that a first responder, even when acting alone, could safely load a patient or remove a patient from the ambulance. The department's new ambulance is also equipped with an air conditioning system in the vehicle's box or mobile treatment center. The new ambulance will be going into service soon. A few remaining technology and radio installations still need to be completed, but I anticipate the ambulance will enter service sometime next week, Butterfield said. And now, back over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Alexandra. Our next story, Lyme disease is a real danger in Massachusetts. How to prevent tick bites. It's written by Rin Velasco Janet Lurkey of USA Today Network, New England. It's tick season now, and Lyme disease feels one bite away. Emergency room visits for tick bites have reached their highest levels for this time of year since 2017. Several regions of the United States are seeing increased tick activity due to warmer temperatures, especially in the Northeast and Midwest, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Massachusetts is one of the 14 states where 90% of U.S. cases of Lyme disease have been reported, according to Harvard Health. If it's not treated quickly, Lyme disease can develop into an irregular heartbeat, chronic arthritis, or Bell's palsy, according to the Massachusetts Department of Health. Lyme disease is an infection caused by the bacterium Borrelia burgdorferi, which itself is primarily spread through tick bites, the CDC said. Early on, it can cause fever, fatigue, headache, and a rash that looks like a bullseye. Many people who don't get treatment develop nervous system problems, the Massachusetts Health website said. These problems include meningitis, which is an inflammation of the membranes covering the brain and spinal cord, facial weakness, also known as Bell's palsy, or other problems with nerves of the head, and weakness or pain, or both, in the hands, arms, feet, and/or legs. You can check if you have any ticks on you, but there aren't many rapid at-home tests for Lyme disease. Most at-home Lyme tests, offered right now, give concerned individuals the chance to collect a sample and send it to a lab for testing, which can take up to a week or more. However, one researcher is trying to break the mold. Erin DeWicke, and Massachusetts Institute of Technology researcher is launching a test people can take at home when they find a tick on themselves or others that can detect Lyme disease in 15 minutes or so. It's called Lyme Alert. You can pre-order yours at their website, and they're set to ship out 5,000 test kits by August of 2026, a CBS Boston report said. Not all ticks carry the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. In other parts of the country, less than 1% of ticks in a region may carry the bacteria, according to Johns Hopkins Medicine. The black-legged tick and the western black-legged tick, also known as deer ticks, can spread Lyme disease, which can lead to a wide range of health problems. Most Lyme disease cases have been reported in the upper Midwest, Northeast, and Mid-Atlantic states. In the Northeast, 50% of adult black-legged ticks carry the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, while up to 25% of the younger or nymph black-legged ticks carry the bacteria. That according to a Dartmouth Health study in 2025. Before the infected tick can spread the germ that causes Lyme disease, it must be attached to a person for at least 24 hours, the Massachusetts Health website said. Black-legged ticks in Massachusetts can also carry the germs that cause other viruses and infections, the State Department of Health said. These ticks are capable of spreading more than one type of germ in a single bite. Prompt treatment during the early stage of the disease prevents later more serious problems, Massachusetts Health said. Individuals with erythema migrans, neurologic Lyme disease, Lyme carditis, or Lyme arthritis may need different treatments, the U.S. Public Health Agency said. If you don't want to get Lyme disease in Massachusetts while you're outside, there are multiple ways to prevent tick bites, the primary means of transmission of the disease. The Massachusetts Health website suggests these procedures. Number one, stay on clear tracks and avoid areas where ticks live, like brushy places with tall grass, shrubs, or leaf litter. Number two, wear light-colored long pants tucked into your socks and high boots. They note this may be difficult to do when the weather is hot, but it will help keep ticks away from your skin and help you spot a tick on your clothing faster, according to the website. Number three, use insect repellent with the chemical N,N-diethylmetatoulamide, also known as DEET or permethrin, for defending yourself against ticks. DEET products should not be used on infants under 2 months of age and should be used in concentrations of 30% or less on older children, the state government health website says. Permethrin products are intended for use on items such as clothing, shoes, bed nets, and camping gear, and should not be applied to skin. And number four, protect and check your pets for ticks. Speak with your veterinarian to see what tick prevention chews, collars, or ointments would be right for you and your pet. Other tick-borne diseases can be transmitted much more quickly, sometimes in as little as 15 minutes. By removing the tick promptly, you can reduce the chance of becoming infected. After enjoying the great outdoors, it's best to perform a preventative tick check on your entire body. Ticks can be as small as a poppy seed. According to the U.S. Forest Service, here are some steps to follow when checking for them. Number one, check your clothes. Remove your clothes and look for hitchhiking ticks on your shoes, backpacks, and outer layers of clothing. Number two, take a shower. As soon as you get back from high-risk areas, take a shower or bathe. This removes unattached ticks and helps you find any that may have attached. Number three, mirror check. Examine each area of your body with a full-length or handheld mirror. Keep an eye out for tiny black dots that could resemble new freckles. And number four, check the hidden spots. Ticks prefer warm, dark, and moist areas on your body, so be sure to focus on your hair, around your ears, underarms, groin, behind the knees, between your toes, and even your belly button. Now we have a local sports story for you. Former Gardner star wins third straight DeLay Memorial Golf Tournament. This is written by Jay Guerin. With another superb display of solid and steady golf over 54 holes, Andrew Johnson captured the 79th annual DeLay Memorial Championship over the Memorial Day weekend at Gardner Municipal. Carding rounds of 70, 76, and 78 for a 224 total, the 35-year-old former Gardner High golf and ice hockey standout won the DeLay for the third consecutive year, joining the late Bob Menny, who won from 1958 to 60, and Pete Gamache, who won from 2003 to 2005, as the only three-in-a-row champions. With his victory, Johnson, who lives in Granby and works as a project engineer for Callaway Golf, enters a select group. Menny went on to win on the PGA Tour, and Gamache is the winningest DeLay champion with 11 titles. I took a little time off from playing before this tournament, so I really didn't know what to expect, said Johnson, who now owns 7 major championships at GMGC, 3 DeLay titles, 3 club championships, and last year's Commissioner's Cup. Johnson quickly found his game was sharp despite the layoff, with his blistering opening round of 1-under-par 70, sinking 4 birdie putts and building a 5-shot lead over Mike Guerin, who had major trouble on the first hole, carding a triple bogey 7 before playing the next 17 holes in 1-over-par. Johnson noted his opening 70 was his lowest round at the Gardner course in a major tournament. Sunday's second round was played in miserable conditions as golfers battled the cold and rain throughout the day. Still, Johnson managed a 76 and took a 7-shot lead into the final 18. On Sunday, it was all about keeping the ball in play and not trying to be a hero, said Johnson, who on Monday's final round under sunny skies carded a 1-over-par 36 on the front nine and coasted to a victory on the back nine, even with a 42. Finishing as runner-up for the second straight year was another former Gardner High ace, Guerin, the current GMGC club champion, who posted rounds of 75, 78, and 77 for a 230 total, 6 shots off the winning pace set by Johnson. Andrew played great, said Guerin. He was going to be very tough to catch after his first round 70. In third, with a 239 total, was 2022 Commissioner's Cup champion Alec Dernalowitz, followed at 242 by Franklin Pierce University golfer Cohen Vieur and 6-time DeLay champion Bill Wilson. Jeff Tobia, who was in the final Memorial Day group with Johnson and Guerin, finished 6th at 243. The DeLay Memorial honors the memory of Donald and Richard DeLay, brothers and Gardner High School graduates who lost their lives in a military training test flight in 1942 in Alabama. Only in their 20s, the DeLay brothers, who were awarded victory medals and Air Force citations of honor, are buried side by side at St. John's Cemetery in Gardner. The DeLay Memorial has been played every year at Gardner Municipal since the inaugural event won by Leo Menny in 1948. As his late father, Phil DeLay, brother of the World War II heroes, did for many years, Doug DeLay was there at the end of the tournament to congratulate the champion during the awards ceremony. After regulation play in the Memorial Division, which allows for handicap strokes, Matt Santos and James Munn, good friends and frequent playing partners in GMGC team events, finished tied at the top of the leaderboard at net 230. In sudden-death format, Santos and Munn, both playing in their first DeLay Memorial Tournament, tied the first playoff hole with bogeys before Santos triumphed with an amazing 25-foot chip-in shot for birdie on the par 4 297-yard second hole. After his long drive, Munn's approach shot on the second hole left him with a birdie putt about 30 feet below the cup, while Santos was buried in deep rough a few feet from the fringe behind the hole. It certainly appeared that Munn had the advantage. However, using a sand wedge, Santos perfectly struck his chip shot down and through the rough a few feet onto the green. As Santos' ball rolled slowly and directly at the hole, Munn said, "That's a nice chip." Indeed, it was. Santos' shot kept rolling and gently nudged the pin before settling into the bottom of the cup for his remarkable birdie. Tied for third place at net 231 were Jeremy Viure and Paul Hutala. Dave Noyes was fifth at 233, followed by John Billings at 234, Roland Rust, 235, Tom Seward, 238, and Jacob Van Hillo and Eric Munier, both at 239. This is Community News from Gardner. It's a weekly production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Now Alexandra Zapantis has the final segment of Gardner News.
Thank you again, Dave. State Police Academy suspended after report cites excessive danger. This is by Brad Petrushin with the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Poor management, inadequate oversight, and an entrenched culture of over-the-top paramilitary training make the Massachusetts State Police Training Academy more dangerous and less effective than many of its peers. A third-party study released May 20th found. The $600,000 study, ordered by Governor Maura T. Healey following the 2024 death of Worcester trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia, yielded more than 100 recommendations and prompted the agency to indefinitely delay its upcoming annual academy, which had been scheduled to start in June. We are fully committed to implementing these recommendations and to maintaining the focus needed to strengthen the academy over the long term, said Colonel Jeffrey Noble, who decided to suspend the academy until dozens of reforms he identified as crucial are implemented. Noble, at a press conference May 19th, said the department would honor the memory of Delgado Garcia, who died following an academy boxing exercise, by meaningful action. The colonel, who came on the job just weeks after the recruit's death, largely declined to comment on the manslaughter charges a prosecutor brought against four of his troopers, citing the open case. The 112-page report that led Noble to order reforms, produced by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, did not examine the specific circumstances surrounding Delgado Garcia's death. The report, styled as a comprehensive operational and cultural assessment of the state police's sprawling New Braintree Academy, only appeared to allude to the death once in passing. However, in scrutinizing injury rates and operations for the past 10 training academies, the report was highly critical of the paramilitary tactics offered at the academy, including the boxing program. The report found the academy has high injury and dropout rates that it attributed to widespread failures in policy and practice. Policies on paper lay out safety protocols and require injuries to be promptly reported. However, in practice, the report said, drill instructors often go off script and trainees feel pressured to keep injuries to themselves. Authors of the report, who observed training exercises at the academy, reported witnessing senior officers who appear to approve of training tactics they deemed excessive, lacking purpose, and demeaning to the trainees. A shift towards sustainable, job-relevant, ethically sound fitness practices with protected recovery periods, comprehensive safety oversight, formal concussion awareness training, and established culture of safety is essential, they wrote. Reform must prioritize evidence-based programming, eliminate punitive physical training, ensure adequate recovery, expand qualified staffing, and create systems that proactively prevent injuries rather than reactively responding to them. The report also questioned the value of head strike training exercises, including boxing, which state police, May 20th, said they would end permanently. The department said it would also implement a number of other safety reforms before starting the next academy, including some that, the report indicated, had been suggested 20 years ago. Program long under scrutiny. The State Police Academy has faced scrutiny for decades. Two recruits died there in the 1980s. No charges were issued in those deaths, the Boston Globe reported. And in 2022, the department reassigned staffers after unauthorized bear crawls on hot pavement. The state in 2006 released another report, commissioned after allegations of hazing, that made a series of recommendations for reforms. In many key areas, little has changed or improved as a result of the recommendations provided in that report, the May 20th report says. The 2006 report, the Boston Herald reported, criticized oversight and training, highlighted personnel shortages, and said the academy failed to adequately screen recruits to ensure they had the physical and mental strength to withstand the rigorous 26-week program. The 2026 report echoed all those critiques. It noted the academy relies on a single fitness staff member and focused at length on deficiencies in the screening process. The authors said the department lacks appropriate fitness benchmarks and does not properly assess the physical and mental capabilities of applicants, allowing underprepared trainees to enter training. This dynamic results in a high number of dropouts and injuries that could have been preventable, said the authors, who faulted the department for not properly documenting injuries or studying trends to avoid them. The report found that many of the same injuries, including to the legs and shoulders, reoccur as a result of unduly harsh training regimens, including unscheduled and punitive exercises. The use of physical training as a form of punishment is explicitly discouraged by leading fitness and tactical training bodies, the authors wrote, calling the practice not only physiologically unsound, but also ethically problematic. Reform efforts must center on the adoption of fitness protocols that are legally defensible, job-specific, and health-promoting, they added. Stress testing critiqued. While the 2026 study faulted police for not improving in key problem areas identified decades ago, its authors also faulted the 2006 report for recommending the department keep some high-stress tactics they found to be inappropriate. Authors said the 2006 report supported many ritualistic and outdated exercises aimed at subjecting trainees to stress for fear that dialing back the intensity would put a stigma on new officers of not having succeeded in the same manner as all other officers of the department. The authors found many of the stress tests served no legitimate purpose, including one in which trainees were shouted at that, the authors wrote, were watched with tacit approval by high-level command staff. An often repeated goal of some members of the academy staff is to be a preeminent law enforcement training agency that delivers cutting-edge training, the report found. However, continued reliance on tradition, outdated rituals, and a desire to exceed the stress exposure experienced by prior recruit classes will stifle this goal. The 2026 authors said that while stress exposure in purposeful training exercises is an important component of training, such exercises should prioritize skill development, psychological readiness, and mutual respect over indiscriminate stress exposure. They recommend the department strike a better balance with their stress exposure, something Noble vowed to do before opening another academy. Noble said he did not have a timetable for when enough reforms might be implemented to begin the next academy. Other reforms that will need to be implemented include establishing a civilian academy director of training position, establishing baseline physical and psychological screening protocols, reinforcing a safety-first culture through training, and building stronger systems for injury tracking and recruit readiness. Noble vows serious changes. Noble, in a background interview with reporters, invited to headquarters May 19th, thanked the International Association of Chiefs of Police for the report and said implementing its recommendations was a priority. A condition of the invitation was that reporters not quote Noble directly on his answers to questions about the report, though they could report the information he provided. Reporters were given a physical copy of the lengthy report at the same time Noble gave quotable opening remarks that could be recorded. Recording of his background answer session was barred. Noble, in answering questions from reporters, said he could not speak for why prior leaders did not implement previously identified reforms, but vowed he would ensure transparency and improvements moving forward. Noble said a key part of the reform effort will be to find the right balance when it comes to rigor. While he said he supports developing a balanced stress training curriculum, he noted that such training is essential to ensuring the state produces troopers capable of handling life-threatening situations. He noted, for example, that a third-year trooper recently helped stop a potentially disastrous mass shooting attempt on Memorial Drive in Cambridge by confronting the gunman as he fired on helpless motorists. Noble stressed that there will still be tough training at the academy, but said it will be thoughtful, purposeful training approved through the chain of command. Asked whether he thought the reforms, if implemented sooner, may have prevented Delgado Garcia's death, he said that's likely an unanswerable question, noting there is much the department will learn as the criminal case unfolds. Noble said his relationship with the police union is strong and that he was confident the department will support the changes being made. The president of the troopers union, at the criminal arraignments of the troopers charged in Delgado Garcia's death, called the charges unwarranted and called on Noble to issue a statement of support for them. Asked by the Telegram and Gazette about that during the session, Noble reiterated his stance on remaining silent as the court process plays out, but added that the troopers are entitled to the presumption of innocence and that they had good reputations prior to the charges. The Telegram and Gazette has reached out to the union for comment on the report. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Alexandra Zapantis. Thank you for listening.
Listeners, on Tuesday, June 2nd at 6 p.m., Speaking Volumes begins a brand new book titled Say Nothing, a true story of murder and memory in Northern Ireland by Patrick Radden Keefe. Be sure to get your copy now for this stimulating conversation.
You say you love a good book, that you enjoy listening to a good story that piques your interest, which challenges your imagination to explore places where it has never gone before? If so, then Audio Journal's Backyard Bookshelf is for you. Backyard Bookshelf is Audio Journal's award-winning book reading program that always has a local flavor, featuring books about New England, as well as books written by local authors or native New Englanders, be it fiction or nonfiction. So join us, won't you? Just tune in every Friday at 4 p.m. and enjoy. That's Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal.